This is a Spirit of Truth Radio Network original program.
My guest in this episode is an amazing guy. He's an author, speaker, documentary filmmaker on matters of faith. Since his conversion to the Catholic Church, he has amassed a wealth of knowledge and shares it openly. He has been featured many times on EWTN, usually from the Holy Land. His energy and zeal are infectious, but I say that he has an intrepid spirit about him that makes him the perfect pilgrim's guide. Joining me along the way is Steve Ray. Steve, welcome.
Well, thank you, Dave. I'm glad to be here.
It's so good to be with you. Steve Ray, you are known for your pilgrimages. You lead some great pilgrimages. There's so much I want to talk to you about. You're a Catholic convert to the faith. Let's talk about that for a minute. How did you come to the Catholic Church?
Well, I didn't see anything good about the Catholic Church. There was nothing that drew me to it. There was no Catholics that I knew that I wanted to be like. All the Catholics I knew were good excuses why I would never be a Catholic. Mm-hmm. I was raised in a Baptist family. My mom and dad were both converts from Billy Graham in 1953. I was born a year after that. So I was born into a family of mom and a dad, very passionate about the Baptist theology. But of course, right along with it, I learned that Catholics were all going to hell. And it was our job to get them saved because they had everything backwards. We Baptists, we had the Bible. The Catholics had tradition. We prayed to God. They prayed to dead saints. We got to heaven by faith in Christ. Catholics got there by their works. I knew every lie and misconception about the Catholic Church you could know. And in fact, when I got older, I taught the Bible and I even taught classes on how to convert Catholics and Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses. The Catholics were just the biggest cult. Mm-hmm. There was nothing that made me want to become a Catholic. But when I was 39 years old, my wife and I both, we got married young and did everything together. We've been married 46 years now, 4 kids and 20 grandkids. And our journey to the Catholic Church began when we started to realize the problems with Protestantism. When we saw the problems there, and I give a whole hour talk on that, and I wrote a book called Crossing the Tiber, which is my conversion story. It's selling now better than it did in 1997 when it first came out. Sometimes you got to realize you're sick before you go see a doctor, especially us guys. Mm-hmm. And so we had to realize that there were problems with Protestantism that could never be corrected. And I almost became an agnostic. Wow. And then a friend of mine named Al Cresta, who was our best friend for 12 years, he was a Protestant pastor. He was a number one radio show host in Detroit for Protestant radio. And one day, after 12 years of great friendship, homeschooling our kids together, studying the Bible together, he just drops the bomb and said, Steve, Sally and I are going to join the Catholic Church. What are you? Al, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. You're way too smart to be a Catholic. But then we tried to study to prove him wrong, to inoculate ourselves, I guess. Mm-hmm. And we started to study the earliest Christians. And we studied about the papacy and about Mary and the Eucharist at all. And my wife and I, we just sat there with our mouths open and said, why didn't we ever know these things? Because we had lived in a Protestant bubble and we'd never read a Catholic book in our life. Hey, let me put it this way, Dave. I knew everything about Catholicism from Protestant sources. That's like going to Israel and I'm going to write a history of the Jewish people, but I only interview Palestinians. How good is my book going to be? So that's kind of how what I did. Once I decided to be fair, when I realized I couldn't be a Protestant anymore, mm-hmm. it was kind of Catholicism or agnosticism in a way, I guess. And when we started to be fair and started to go back and read, actually forgot about what Billy Graham and Martin Luther said and go back and see what Irenaeus and Justin Martyr and Clement of Rome and Ignatius of Antioch and these guys that were eaten by lions, what they thought. And all of a sudden I realized the early church was Catholic and I wanted to get back on the train that started back in the first century. And by the way, we came into the church on Pentecost Sunday, which I don't know when this is going to air, but we're doing this Sunday coming up is our 29th anniversary into the church. We came in with 6 of us, my wife and 4 kids, and now there's 30 of us.
That's beautiful. You know, the whole family coming in like that, that's just amazing. Steve, tell me a little bit, what does a Protestant pilgrimage, are there such things as Protestant pilgrimages?
No, there are Protestant tours.
Okay.
Martin Luther was very opposed to pilgrimages because in those days they were viewed as ways to go towards repentance, to do penance. And he viewed them as people going there to earn their salvation, so to speak. So Protestants have always had an aversion to that. And I never went on a pilgrimage or a tour like this prior to becoming Catholic. I had spent a year in Europe. I lived in the Swiss Alps with my wife and our kids when they were young, with a Protestant theologian named Dr. Francis Schaeffer. And any Protestant will immediately know who he is. He was called the missionary to the intellectuals. And we went and spent a year living there. We sold everything and moved there. And we studied our Reformation history. I was going in a way to learn my Protestantism better, living in the community with this man, this theologian. And we went back again and did the same thing on a tour through 13 countries in Europe, mainly trying to bolster my Protestant thinking and ideas and to get rooted in the European history that way. Mm-hmm. But I never had a desire to go to Israel, never had the desire to go to the biblical lands until after I became a Catholic. Now, you ask about Protestants. A lady just wrote to me today and she says, someday I'm going to go with you because I went a couple of years ago with two friends of mine who are Protestant. She said, I was so disappointed. She said, we went past Catholics celebrating Mass and we had to just keep walking. We couldn't stop. And they don't go to many of the sites that we Catholics go to. For example, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which everybody knows is the place where Christ was crucified and buried. Archaeology, history, the earliest pilgrims wrote about it. But in 1850s, the Protestants came up with a new site out the Nablus Road about a half a mile, and they call it the Garden Tomb. And they claim that that is the place where Jesus was crucified and buried and rose again. And there's no evidence for it whatsoever. But Protestants, even I took my parents once, and they insisted that I take them there. But that's pretty much where a lot of the – I'm talking about fundamentalist Protestants, kind of like the Baptist Bible churches. And they don't like to go to Nazareth because that's very Marian, you know, where Hail Mary, full of grace, the angel came. And it's but that's where the incarnation started. I mean, to think of not going there. Everything started in Nazareth. That's mm-hmm. where the angel said, you're going to give birth to a son. And then in her womb, there are cells too small for us to see, but God had become man in her womb. And on the altar there, it says, the word became flesh here.
Wow.
To miss that place is a scandal. And what ends up happening is Protestants end up going to a lot of the Israeli national parks because they cannot celebrate their services in these Catholic churches. You have to be a Catholic priest to celebrate in those churches. And so there you often see them sitting out under a tree. I really had a sad experience one time. We had been in Gethsemane, and we had Mass around the rock where Jesus had sweat drops of blood. That's called hematidrosis, by the way. There's a medical term for that. And we had Mass around that rock.
Wow.
And all of the Masses there are site-specific. So they're not the readings of the day that you read here. They are, in Gethsemane, it's always the reading of the agony. At the tomb, it's always Easter Sunday morning Mass every day. And we had this wonderful Mass. Everybody had tears in their eyes, and we walked out and I saw four Protestants with these little plastic cups of grape juice, and they opened up these little crackers and they ate them. And then they took the cellophane, the aluminum foil off the, and they drank the Welch's grape juice. And in 2 minutes, they had their communion out there, outside. I just said, how impoverished, how sad.
Yeah.
So Protestants basically go around with a Bible and a notebook, and they don't have a sacramental aspect. See, the Catholics, this is, I think, why when I became Catholic, I had this insatiable desire to go, because all of a sudden I realized there's an incarnational sacramental aspect to our faith. God actually walked there, therefore it's holy ground. The Jordan River, you don't have to have the water blessed. It's already holy water because Jesus stepped into that water. So the places that you're there, that you're at, they have sacramental graces. Nobody goes there and comes back the same. I say to you, to people, you think you're going to go touch the land? Be careful, because the land is going to reach up and touch you too.
Well, that brings me to my next question. I can hear it in your voice that when you went there, you were truly moved. Do you still feel that same way?
Let me tell you, the first time I went there, not as much, but I still do. I've been there over 200 times. So on the 200th time, it's not going to be quite like the first time. Mm-hmm. I remember it was the old airport where you didn't get off a jet bridge. You got off on the tarmac and you had to go down the steps and go. And I remember when I stepped onto that ground the first time in 1995, I fell on that blacktop tarmac and I cried. And my poor wife just stood there saying, Steve, we got to go. Steve, we got to go. But I'm flat on my face on the tarmac. I'm just crying. I realized this is where God started his whole plan of salvation. This is where Jesus walked. This is the prophets and the kings and the priests. And I just was overcome. And I cried through, my wife and I both, we cried through the whole pilgrimage. One time they asked me to do a reading at Mass. And I stood up and I said, a reading from the second letter of Peter. I stood up there for over a minute trying to read, and I finally sat down and the priest had to get somebody else to do the reading. So that was, my wife had just become a Eucharistic minister and she was giving communion to people just crying at the tomb of Christ. Mm. I mean, can you imagine? Because at the tomb of Christ, he died and was buried, and the witnesses then, he came out of the tomb. I tell my folks, when we have Mass at the tomb, he's going to come out for you again in the form of the Blessed Sacrament. He's going to be coming out, and you're going to greet him as he comes out this morning and receive him in the Eucharist. So how could I not be in tears? Now, I've been there over 200 times. We've led 100 groups, and always I've had the same guide for 100 times. His name is Amr. He's a Roman Catholic from Nazareth, just the best. Otherwise, I wouldn't use him 100 times. Mm. And when we get on the bus, I say, people always ask me, does it ever get old? Do you ever get tired of doing this? And I said, no, because I get to see it again for the first time through your eyes.
Yes, I was going to ask you that. It must be amazing to see the reaction of people, you know, to see your emotions through them.
Yeah, you know? And tears in their eyes. A guy told me, it was the one story, and then we can go to another topic, but a guy came on the third day. We were going to have Mass at Capernaum, which is where Jesus said, eat my flesh and drink my blood, in the synagogue. And that was the readings for the Mass. He said to me, Steve, I want you to know I'm a reluctant pilgrim. He said, my wife went fishing with me up north last year, so this was my agreement. I'd have to come to Israel with her this year. It was a trade-off. So I said, no problem. I said, I'm just glad you're here with us. He came out of that Mass where Jesus said the words, eat my flesh and drink my blood. And he had tears running down his eyes. And he said, Steve, I'm not a reluctant pilgrim anymore. I just realized where I am.
Yeah, imagine. Steve, what's the difference? What's the meaning of pilgrimage?
The word pilgrimage means sojourner, somebody who goes on a journey I don't want to use the word pilgrim because that's what we're defining, but a sojourner, a traveler who leaves the comfort of his home and what he's familiar with. Mm-hmm. And he goes on a journey for a number of reasons. One, to find God, to do penance, to discover the land of our Lord or something of that nature. Pilgrimages they didn't begin with us, of course. Jesus went on a pilgrimage at least once a year. They left Nazareth, his hometown, and at least 30 times when he was living in Nazareth there with Mary and Joseph for part of that time, they would go on a pilgrimage and they would have to walk 100 miles, 80, 90, 100. But if it was straight, it would be 80, but you know, it's not straight. Mm-hmm. They'd walk 90 to 100 miles to arrive in Jerusalem. And even though they're going from Nazareth south, you never go down to Jerusalem. You always, 23 times in the Bible, you go up to Jerusalem because it's the highest place in the world. That's where God dwells. Mm-hmm. And it's also on a mountain. So you always go up to Jerusalem, even if you're going down on the map. And they went every year, at least for Passover. And that would be almost a week's journey of walking one way. And they had 15 psalms. People don't realize this. They're called the Psalms of Ascent, the Psalms of Going Up. Some translations of the Bible even title them the Songs of Pilgrimage, Psalms 120 through 134. And these psalms, they would chant and sing as they were on their way up to Jerusalem. One of them is Psalm 122. I rejoiced when they said to me, let us go to the house of the Lord. Mm. And so I read that Psalm 122 to our group on the buses we're pulling into Jerusalem, because that's what Jesus did. He went on a pilgrimage, and there were all these different kinds. It's kind of, I think, built into the human psyche mm-hmm. to want to go and discover these places. And we have it pretty darn easy today. We get on a Delta flight mm-hmm. and we got food served us in bathrooms and so it's a flight over there. Yeah, it's still grueling. You get jet lag and everything, but you know, from New York, say, to Israel is like 12 hours with a layover. Mm-hmm. And but we still get and I'm waiting for them there when they arrive. I've got a Mercedes bus, air conditioning, USB ports for your smartphones to plug in, water in the refrigerator. And we go for 2 hours and we arrive at a nice hotel with a beautiful food and wine and beer with dinner. Now, the early pilgrims that went in the first couple of centuries, you know, they went to the Holy Land. If you were going to that, you'd be leaving from Europe and you would say goodbye to your family, not knowing if you'd ever see them again, mm-hmm. because it would be at least a year. Our trips are 10 days from the day you leave till the day you get back. But they would go, it would be at least a year, and they would get on a ship and they would go across the ocean and then through the Mediterranean. Then they'd have to get on camels and go into the land. And it would be where we can hit 3 or 4 sites in a day at times, even with time for mass and prayer. Yep. They probably only hit a site every other day. And they didn't know if they were going to get sick. They didn't have hospitals over there. Some of the knights, like the Hospitallers and the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre, which I'm a Knight of the Holy Sepulchre, they would set up like very primitive inns for these people. But can you imagine? You would be so seasick on the sea, and then you'd get there. Maybe people lost their lives in shipwrecks. Paul was shipwrecked 4 times on the Mediterranean. And they would finally arrive there and get in camels and they'd go through the land. And I know one lady named Egeria who went in 385 from Spain. I think it was a 2-year journey for her. You say goodbye to everybody, not ever knowing if you'd ever see them again.
Wow. The way you describe it, Steve, is the folks back then were actually like a real pilgrimage. It almost sounds like a vacation, but it's still, even though it's not a vacation, right?
Yeah, we emphasize, and I send out letters ahead of time, and I said, this is not a vacation or a holiday, it's a pilgrimage, and that's a very different thing. Now, you're going to have nice beds. I have people that come with me know that my prices are more expensive than others because I don't nickel and dime you along the way. And we have nice hotels. We have nice meals. We go out to really elegant restaurants, wine with our dinners. You get a nice handbook that I made, a 110-page book that I wrote with color, and beautiful buses. And so we call it a pilgrimage, but nobody suffers. Mm-hmm. Nobody really suffers. But it's not, you're not there to dip your toes in the pool and drink daiquiris and margaritas all day. We move. There's a lot of things to see and do in masses, and we pray the rosary at each of the rosary sites. And I give talks at all the sites so people understand the connection between the Old and the New Testament at the top of the Mount of Transfiguration and at Gethsemane. And so it is a pilgrimage in the sense that everybody's left the comfort of home. Mm-hmm. They leave and they know they're going to be up at 6 in the morning or 5 in the morning, and we're going to go all day. And there's a lot to do and see. And so in that sense, it's a pilgrimage. It's not a holiday or a vacation for sure.
Steve, when you go to these places, is holy places, is holy sites and sacred sites? Can you tell me the difference between the two?
Yes, when Moses saw the burning bush, he had walked that way every morning with his sheep and goats, mm-hmm. and it was just dirt and rocks, and he walked there with his sandals every day. Now, today, that Tuesday or Wednesday, whatever day it was, there's a burning bush. And everything's on fire there. And God says, take off your sandals because you're standing on holy ground. Moses could have said, well, what are you talking about? I've been walking on this dirt for 40 years. which he had. Mm-hmm. But it was holy ground, and he had to take his shoes off. What made it holy? God was there. His presence was there. I've been to Rome 150 times too. I've been to, you know, all of like Lourdes and Fatima. We take groups there, and Poland, John Paul II, Maximilian Kolbe, and Maria Faustina, all these, Guadalupe, and all of these places. I made the distinction in my own mind, I don't know that other people do, that they're sacred sites. They're in a sense consecrated by the presence of saints and the Catholic faith, but only the place, I only call the places where Jesus walked, where God came down. Mm-hmm. That's why my movies that I made, 9 movies, all on location, they're called The Footprints of God. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to emphasize that God actually became incarnate. He became a man. You know where it says that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then verse 14, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. That word dwelt means tent. It's actually in Greek, tent. He tented among us. He put up his tent, which is the flesh, and he lived in this tent with us. Hmm. And so that's it gives you the image of the tabernacle in the Old Testament, where Moses built the tabernacle, the tent, and the presence of God was there in that tent. And Jesus is now the new presence of God in the tent of his body. And so where he walked, I tell people, this is holy ground because he stepped here. When God touches something, it's not the same ever again. And so where he walked, I call that holy ground, and it's, to me, it's distinct from any secular ground or even sacred ground with saints. But when God touches something, that's a whole different thing. That's holy ground.
Oh, that's beautiful. Do you have a particular holy ground or site that really sticks out to you, that really still touches you?
I hate when people ask me that. I'm sorry.
Well, you had to see it coming, you know?
I do. Every time I talk about it, it comes. I always hate that question because it's like I have 20 grandchildren. So if you ask me, which one do you like the best? Which one stands out among the other 20? Mm-hmm. Well, my goodness, how can I pick one grandchild over another? They all have their special places, things. But I do. And I have to say it's this way. The two I would say that are my favorite, maybe not my favorite because they're pleasant to be that or the most beautiful, but the ones that are the most meaningful, I would have to say, is Nazareth and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, about 80, 90 miles apart, because it wasn't without Nazareth, mm-hmm. where the angel spoke to Mary. She's only a 15-year-old girl, and she lives in a cave. And I like to ask people, what do you think the Holy Family did when the first thing in the morning when they woke up? What was the first? And they all say, they prayed. And I said, is that the first thing you do in the morning when you get up? And everybody looks, no, we go to the bathroom. So I said, do you realize that you just tried to make the Holy Family like they're not really human, that they walked 3 feet above the ground, they don't have any bodily functions, whatever. But they lived a very rustic life in a cave with no plumbing. And Mary's a 15-year-old girl, and it seems that she was afraid because the first thing the angel says, don't be afraid, don't be afraid, because it was a very strange thing that Mary.
Yeah.
And when Mary said yes, you're going to give birth to a son, and your son will be seated on the throne of his father, David. There had not been a king on the throne of Israel for 600 years. It had been 600 years since a king had sat on a throne of Israel. They'd been under the domination of the Babylonians and the Syrians and the Romans. And now this little girl gets this message. And when she said yes, in her womb, she became the spouse of the Holy Spirit. And in her womb, those cells were too small for you to see with your human eye, but they were already 100% God and 100% man. Mm-hmm. So that's why at the altar in that cave, it says the Word became flesh here. Without Nazareth, there would be no Bethlehem. There would be no Jerusalem. There would be no salvation. It all starts in Nazareth. And can you believe it? A lot of Protestants don't even go there. Now, that's the first one that I would have to say is one of my very favorite, very special ones. And then the Holy Sepulchre, for some reasons, it's my worst of all places to go to because of the crowds and the pushing and the shoving and the difficulties of getting into the tomb, for example, and so on. Mm-hmm. But then it's also my other favorite, because where else on earth did the Son of God, who left heaven and came down to earth and became a man, and he suffered and died, the scandal of the incarnation. Can you imagine? The angel said, he's going to do what? He's going to go down and become one of them? They don't even obey him. They can't even fly. They perspire. What? Why would he want to become one of them? And then when they find out that he's not only going to go down and become one of them, the scandal of the incarnation, but now you have the scandal of the cross. You mean he's actually going to die for them? What is he thinking? The angels are saying, what's he thinking? But here he does. He comes down, and you have time and space and eternity all intersecting at the under that one roof, where he dies and sheds his blood right there atop of Calvary. We at 5 o'clock in the morning, we pray the Via Dolorosa, where we don't have the crowds. I don't go there when there's the crowds. Mm-hmm. We go, I shouldn't give my secrets away, but we go really early in the morning when it's still dark. We pray the Via Dolorosa when you can be reverent about it. And we get to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre before anybody else is there. I take them up to the top. And I said, you're going to reach now under this altar, and you're going to touch a stone. That rock is where the cross stood. And if you had touched that 2,000 years ago, your fingers would come up sticky with his blood. That's what you're touching. Now, can you imagine people, the tears in their eyes, they're sobbing as they go and they touch that, knowing that's where Jesus shed his blood for their sins. And then you walk, come down the steps from Calvary, and you walk less than 30 seconds or a minute, and there's the tomb. And that's where they laid his cold, clammy body there. And he laid there, and he went, and on Sunday morning, he came back alive again. And everybody, we take him in the tomb, and I said, now you go home and you tell all your family and friends that you were in the tomb, and you can verify that the tomb is empty. Yeah. Those are my two favorite places.
That's amazing. You had brought up about the Holy Family, what the first thing they do. Can you imagine being St. Joseph at that breakfast table? Can you pass the cereal to, you know, you got Jesus on one side and Blessed Mother on the other.
Yep.
Can't imagine.
We always joking, and we always joke and say that if there was ever an argument or a problem, Joseph would always say, okay, it's my fault. He's living perfect people.
Absolutely. One more question about that. Are those places, are they handicap accessible, or because you mentioned there was some trouble getting people into it?
We do not take people with walkers or wheelchairs. I have, but it's very difficult, and they can't get to a lot of places because it is not at all like United States. There's a lot of stairs. There's a lot of rough terrain to go over. Mm-hmm. Going up to the Visitation is a very steep walk for quite a way, and it's uneven. I've had one nun who, I told everybody, watch where you're walking, watch where you're walking. She fell and smashed her face on a rock and broke her hip. And she was walking fine. So mm-hmm. I did take Al Cresta in a wheelchair. I did do that because he's my best friend, and I was going to do it no matter what. And we had two people come with him that mm-hmm. were not going to take pictures or do anything. They only had to be there to help Al. And so we paid for two people to come just to help him get around. And even then, he couldn't get to everywhere.
Poland. What are some of the sites you like to go to in Poland?
Poland is the land of the modern saints, John Paul II. We go to all the sites related to him, to his birthplace, where he had his first mass. Now they've built a beautiful John Paul II center, Wadowice. That's where he's from. We go. We also follow the life of Maria Faustina. We go to her convent. Mm-hmm. We pray with her sisters there at the 3 o'clock hour, at the Divine Mercy hour. I remember a funny story. I'll just add a little humor here. We were praying the Divine Mercy. It's all in Poland. So I had my iPhone here, and I had the Divine Mercy in English, and the Mother Superior saw me, and she came running over, and she said, no, she thought I was like playing video games or something. And I said, sister, it's Divine Mercy, I don't know Polish. So she said, oh, so sorry. it was very cute, actually. So we pray right in the front of her body, and we have one of her sisters give a talk to us, and they give everybody the day to enjoy that place. Maximilian Kolbe You know, here you are sitting, we're sitting here talking, communication with earphones on and so on. He's one of the founders of radio, of doing, using radio to get the gospel out in Poland at the time.
Wasn't his radio network Immaculata?
Yes. And he had a whole city called Immaculata. And he had a lot of brothers there, and they did publishing. In fact, a lot of people say Poland survived Nazis and the Soviet Union because of all of his publishing and radio. He educated the people so well beforehand that when they came in, the people were well-educated folks in the Catholic faith. So we follow him. Now, in following him, we also go to Auschwitz, mm-hmm. which is very sobering. It's not gory. It's not what some people are afraid of. They're going to see bodies laying around or anything like that. But it does give you a sense of what happened there. And we always have excellent, excellent Catholic guides mm-hmm. that take us around through Auschwitz. And that is, you see the ovens where they burned the Jews and the Poles and the Catholic priests. And it's very sobering. And I like taking people there because I said, you know, this is less than 100 years ago. In Germany, which had Bach and Mozart and Beethoven, it was an educated, literate, intelligent land, even religious. And how could they fall into this so rapidly? The inhumanity that they had, and if it could happen to them, it can happen now. We have to be aware of that, and we have to resist with every effort all kinds of tyranny and repression and so on. And I think it's happening in our country now, and people, it's a good wake-up call for people to walk through Auschwitz and see what can happen if we don't use our freedoms to fight tyranny and cancel culture and everything else we're seeing today. So Poland is fast, and we go for a day up to Zakopane. That's the mountains in the north where John Paul went skiing. Mm-hmm. And we spend a day up there just really having a good time and go up on the mountain and having dinner up there and in this really cool restaurant. It's made out of logs. But we're going in August of this year. And if people want to go, we still have some seats left. Mm-hmm. Go to Catholic Convert. That's my website, catholicconvert.com. Click on the pilgrimage link and you can sign up and go. It's one of the least expensive pilgrimage destinations today. I don't know why, but it's almost $1,500, $2,000 less than going to Israel or England or somewhere. Wow. So Poland is a great place to go. It's a wonderful country. And don't be afraid of the whole situation with Ukraine. People are afraid of that. It has nothing whatsoever to do with a pilgrimage to Poland today.
How far away? I mean, I know it's a whole different country, but how far away are those pilgrimage sites from, say, the Russian border?
The Russian border quite a ways, but it is on the Ukrainian border. But, you know, Poland is part of the European Union. Yeah. And the Warsaw and the NATO. And so there's no way in the world Russia was stupid enough to go into Ukraine, but that was still neutral territory. That's, you know, they could do that, but they would never dare cross the line into a NATO Western Europe country. So the people, there's no, and all my friends, my contacts there say, Steve, there's no issues whatsoever. That's and cool. It's a wonderfully Catholic, beautiful Catholic country. The masses on Sunday, you can't even get into the mass on Sunday.
Yeah. How's the food in Poland? Oh,
they sausage and all the food that they have there is marvelous. You know, it's just, and we go to really nice restaurants and the good Polish beers and things too. So mm-hmm. when you come with us, you're always going to have a culinary experience.
Where's the best place for food that you've been to? Cause I have an idea. I know what I would think it is, but I'm going to see if you agree.
Well, we love the sauerkraut and the bratwurst and the sausages. It's a little bit like Germany in that sense, you know.
Okay.
And they have wonderful one thing that Americans aren't quite ready to eat yet is the black pudding or the sausage, which is made out of blood.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to serve mass for a group of Polish nuns here in Connecticut, and they would always have breakfast for me waiting and I could never bring myself to eating that. So it was, yeah. No, the reason I ask is because, I mean, you've mentioned that you've been to Rome. I just think Rome must have absolutely the best food.
Oh, it's the best food in the world. There's just no doubt about it. It's the best food in the world. Yeah, If I had to be marooned or abandoned in one city for 6 months, I would choose Rome.
Yeah.
I love Jerusalem and I love Krakow and mm-hmm. I love, other cities too, but if I had to be in one city for 6 months, I'd choose Rome. 800 churches.
Yeah. My friend, and Father John Wykes, is an American who's living in Rome. So he's got it rough, Father John.
Oh, terrible.
Yeah.
You can't find a bad restaurant in Italy.
Well, I'll tell you what, I married a Sicilian, so I know what good Italian food is.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah. And I'm Irish, so I'm, you know, the only thing I can cook is a potato. Hey, Dave Imhoff is out there, and I just wanted to see if he had anything that he wanted to ask Steve.
Yeah, thanks. One concern that people have, and there's one person in particular I'm thinking about, my wife, is when going to the Holy Land, and that's what they, because I really want to go, the security.
Yep. I get that question all the time. I should actually have my wife come answer that for you, because nobody trusts me. I'm known as the intrepid traveler, Jerusalem Jones. I'll go anywhere. But my wife, if I had her here, I know what she'd say. She said, look, we take our grandchildren there. We've been there over 200 times. We've never once had a problem. We take thousands of people. And I get them on the bus and I said, how many of you had family and friends say to you, you're going where? Are you crazy? We'll pray the rosary for you every day and you're going to get killed over there, whatever. I said, okay, now at the end of the trip, I'm going to ask you a question. At the end of the trip, I say, how many of you ever felt threatened or in any way felt intimidated or unsafe? And they all laugh at themselves, said, we've never felt safer. When people say, aren't you afraid to go to Israel? I say, no, I'm afraid to go to Detroit. I'm not afraid to go to Israel. It's much safer, I think, in Israel than it is in most places or a lot of places in the United States or the rest of the world. One of the things that you realize is that that land is only 8,000 square miles. It fits inside Lake Michigan 2.5 times. Probably it's the same size as Connecticut. It's the size of New Jersey, almost exactly. And that country always is on the news. For some reason, Americans love to tell everything that goes wrong in Israel. How many people get killed in Chicago on a given weekend?
Good point.
And nobody hears about that. And still people fly into Chicago for business or pleasure without even thinking a thing about it. And there's far more people. Hardly anybody gets killed in Israel. And usually it's in the West Bank. And it's usually between the Palestinian Muslims and the soldiers. It's not with us. We're the customers. They love us. Whenever you hear about a fight or a problem, it's usually between the soldiers and the Palestinians somewhere in a Palestinian area. We don't go near any of those areas. We don't go near Gaza. When you come with us, you're going to be probably at one of the safest times of your life.
Steve, please forgive me. I don't know if I'll ever get a chance to go on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, but you hear about the Wailing Wall. Is that part of your tour?
Oh, yes. And it's the Wailing Wall or the Western Wall. That's the same thing. And we take everybody there and I bring them right up to it. And I explain everything about the Western Wall, why it's there, what it is. And I say, do you remember where it says that there won't be one stone left upon another and that you see all these stones up there? Why is that? Because I say that it's the temple was on top of it. See, Herod, it's Mount Moriah. See, these are all things I love to teach people when I'm there. Abraham offered his son on Mount Moriah. A father with his only begotten son, Isaac, offered him on Mount Moriah as a picture of another father with an only begotten son who would offer him on the same mountain 2,000 years later, God the Father with his son. And that mountain is like a hump. And when Solomon built his temple there, he had to build it on top of that mountaintop. So you had to go up to get in. Herod, he was an amazing architect, or his guys were, and he wanted to have a platform. So he built 4 retaining walls. And he filled it all in with dirt and built a platform on top. So that mountain is now incorporated in this big platform. That platform holds 30 football fields. And then he built the temple 10 stories high on top of that platform. So when he says there won't be another one stone left upon another, he meant of the temple, which came down. But the retaining walls are still there today. You can see them. The Western Wall, what that means is it's the Western retaining wall that Herod built as part of the Western Wall to build and hold up that platform, which the temple was going to be on. So it's there. And we take our group down there and they pray and they touch the wall and they put their prayers in the wall. And I explained to them all about why the Jews bob when they pray and the box they put on their forehead and this phylacteries. And it's fun. People, it's a very moving time for them to see the Western Wall.
Beautiful. You know, you told a story about a father who was going to sacrifice his son. And then God said, stop.
Yep.
And then when God sent his son, we said, crucify him.
Yep.
Nobody said stop. Your ways are not my ways. God said that. Yep. And how true is it? Just because of that one story.
Yep. I just wrote a book on Genesis. It's coming out by Ignatius Press in July. It's called Genesis, a Bible study guide and commentary. It's about 500 pages. It's the first commentary on Genesis, Catholic commentary that I know of.
Really?
At least the last 50 or 100 years. And it's very readable, and it goes through the whole book of Genesis, talks about Abraham, and I bring out all those typology and the parallels told in New Testament. So It's going to be out in, I think, July or August.
How long does it take you to put together a commentary on something like that? That's got to be...
Well, if I had just sat down and done it, probably a year.
Really?
But I worked on it probably 3 or 4 years with, you know, bits and pieces here. But the last year, I really, when COVID was here, I really... went through and finished it all And put it all in. I had a big compliment from the editor who has been editing books for over 40 years. She said, I had a problem editing your book because I got so engrossed in what you said, I'd go 10 pages and forget that I was supposed to be editing it. Now, I took that as a huge compliment.
That is a huge compliment.
Readable. Yeah. It reads like a novel. Yeah.
That's great, man. Is there anything that I'm missing?
Maybe some practical aspects of pilgrimages. Not all pilgrimages are created equal.
Okay.
I'll say that much. There's a lot of pilgrimages that are just getting people over there and they use old buses and they stay. They'll promise a 5-star hotel and, oh, they're busy, so we had to use a 3-star hotel and they eat buffet food everywhere. You know, there's a big difference.
Yeah.
In quality of pilgrimages. And you may get a Muslim guide. You may get a Jewish guide. There are not many Catholic guides. And there's a lot of Muslim guides that say they're Christian and they're not. And, you know, if you're going to spend money to go there once, you should make sure you pick the right trip. And I've tried to make ours really be the top-notch quality trip to go on. My price, when I set it, it's that price. When you get over there, you don't have to pay tips and taxes and meals and lunches and all that stuff. All of everything's included already in my price. So it looks like my price is a lot higher than everybody else's, but also my wife and I are coming and we're doing teaching along the way, and it costs extra money for us to come along. And, but you get great food, wine with dinners, and always the people that come are classy, very like-minded Catholic folks. Mm-hmm. And another thing that nobody else does, I make a movie of the trip. So when you get home, you get a 2-hour movie of your trip.
That's really cool.
You know, the other trips that we take, for example, Poland, we talked about in October of 2024, we do a St. Paul cruise in the Mediterranean Sea and we hit 10 biblical sites. And this time we're going to start off in Rome for 3 days in Rome, then hit the highlights of Rome. And then we're going to take this drive across Italy, see the the face cloth of Christ at Menapello and the Eucharistic miracle of Lanciano, which is the oldest and most powerful Eucharistic miracle there is. And then we take the super fast 5-star ferry across the Adriatic Sea to Greece. And then we get on our ship and we go all the way around the Mediterranean and we hit 10 biblical sites. And at each site, I give talks about the St. Paul and what he did. And we have mass at Mary's house in Ephesus. And we do a lot of wonderful things there. And Island of Patmos, where John wrote the book of Revelation. We spend a whole day in Ephesus. And if you could put it this way, if Christianity was born in Israel, it grew up in Turkey and Greece. The first 8 ecumenical councils of the church took place in Turkey. People don't realize that. The first 8 ecumenical councils, which are shared by the Greek Orthodox and all the traditions, they all took place in Turkey. Mm-hmm. And Christianity was born in Israel, but it grew up in Turkey and Greece, and then it had its glory in Rome. kind of the glory of Christendom is in Rome. So to visit all those sites of St. Paul and to get a feel for that guy, what it was like for him to travel. For example, he had four shipwrecks. Now, he only mentions three, but after he mentioned those, he had another one at the end of the book of Acts. When I'm out there on the ship with people, I tell them, go out on the deck in the middle of the night some night if you can't sleep, and look out over there and imagine being shipwrecked that night and floating on a piece of driftwood. And Paul said he spent a night and a day in the deep. Wow. And just imagine, I said, I tried to arrange for a bad storm and a shipwreck so you could have the real experience. But that trip is really a marvelous trip. Then also in 2025, we're going to do the saints and shrines of Italy, because it's going to be the 2025 is a jubilee year. And we're anticipating they're going to bring the Shroud of Turin out again for display. And we start up in Milan and Turin. We see the shroud and we see all the beauty of Milan. It's unbelievable. And then we come down and we hit Florence, the tomb of Augustine, Assisi, Padre Pio, all along the coastline, the cave of St. Michael, the face cloth of Christ, the Eucharistic miracle of Lanciano. And then we spend the last 3 days in Rome. So that's a really cool trip. And we're covering most of the big saints and shrines of Italy. We really move through that trip, though, because we, in about 8 days, we start in the north and we move all the way down. But it's really a lot of fun.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Steve, I got to ask you a personal question. What is your background? Yeah.
My background, meaning career-wise?
Yeah, you seem to have so much energy. I mean,
I started several businesses. My dad told me when I grew up, he was an unusual guy. And he said, never go to college because it's a waste of time and money. He said, when you get out of high school, start your own business. You'll make more money that way. During high school, I did janitorial work on the weekends with a friend to make pocket money. Mm-hmm. So when I graduated, I said, what do I know how to do? I know how to clean offices. So I took 3x5 cards. I cut them in half and wrote my name and phone number on them. I bought a vacuum and a mop bucket at a garage sale for $25. And I went door to door to all these little office buildings and said, I'll clean your office for you. I'd say, okay, here's the key. Send us an invoice at the end of the month. And I built that up to $12 million a year with 600 employees. We'd started my wife and I out of the dining room. We got married young and we started out of our dining room, and I built that business up to be quite a big business. And, then when we became Catholic, I lost interest in that business and I sold it so that I could do what I do now. So now we make our living through pilgrimages, writing books, giving talks and conferences all over. And I, at one time, had 600 employees, and I swore I'll never have another employee, and I don't. I can do this now, what I do, from our dining room. So we have several, that business, but we also have the pilgrimage business called Footprints of God. We have the movie-making business called St. Joseph Productions. We have the conferences and authors, and that's called Crossing the Tiber Productions. So we keep pretty busy, and we keep our grandkids all involved. They handle my website for me, and they ship products out from the website, and they do a lot of things. Now my son is doing something new, and if anybody wants to donate towards this or send young people on it, he's standing on my shoulders in a way, and he started something called Inheritance Pilgrimages, and he's taking young college students to Israel, and he's immersing these young students in the Bible and in the Catholic inheritance that they have. You see, the Jews send 50,000 young people from the United States to Israel every year. It's called birthright. They send them over to learn their birthright in the land of Israel. We said, wait a minute, we're losing 9 out of 10 of our kids when they go through college. Mm-hmm. Catholics, we're losing our kids, 9 out of 10 of them, pretty much. Why don't we do what the Jews do? And let's take our young people to the Holy Land when they're getting out of high school in the first years of college. We'll call it Inheritance Pilgrimage. We're getting donations so that we can help them do it for just much less money to go. And we took a group of 45 in March, and you would not believe the impact it had on those kids. They will be Catholics the rest of their life. So parents and grandparents want their kids to stay Catholic. Go to inheritancepilgrimages.com and send them with my son, and your kids will stay Catholic.
I will make sure I put that in the show notes.
Steve, yeah, and if they want to donate money, it's a tax deductible donation. It's, you can use it for tax planning.
That's awesome. Dave Imhoff, Dave, you got one more question about...
What's the best time to go to the Holy Land, time of year? Or what are the pros and cons at the different times of year?
Israel can be hot in the summer, so I don't take any groups in July and August. It's just too sweltering hot. It can be over 110 degrees in places. My favorite time to go, we take a group every year over Christmas break. So we leave around the 27th and we get back on January 6th. So families can take their families, and we call it a family Christmas Holy Land pilgrimages. And we fill those buses every year with families coming. And it's a lot of fun to see those kids interact with these sites. And that was my favorite because of the temperature. And there's not as many people there over the Christmas break. It's not as crowded in Israel. We also take groups in February, March, though I like the cooler months. Those are my favorite, November, December, January, February. Now, those are also, though, the drawback, to be honest with you, is the days are shorter. If you go in April, May, and June, the days are longer, but it gets to be more warm. But then again, we got great air conditioning on the buses and the hotels. And the end of September, October, November are very nice times, too. If you hate heat, then come in towards the winter months.
Steve, we're getting towards the end of our time with you. I just want to ask you, are there some things are there some websites that people can go to? Is there, you know, to buy your books?
Yeah.
To, you know,
everything.
Talk about yourself.
Okay. Well, I'm recovering from my knee surgery, and by August 1st, they say I'll be as good as new and out leading that group through Poland, and then 4 trips to Israel still this year. On those trips to Israel, two trips are already sold out, and 2 of them were still have a few seats left. Everything is very simple. My website is Catholic Convert. That's how we started the show. I'm a convert to the Catholic Church. So everything is there. It's like a big wheel. You go to Catholic Converts, like the hub of the wheel. And then there's spokes that go to my blog, which I write things up every day about where Jesus rose into heaven and all the meanings of Pentecost, all those kind of things. Then there's another spoke that goes off to hundreds of documents that I've written where people can use them to defend the Eucharist and the priesthood and the papacy and Mary. Hundreds of documents. Feel free to print them out and use them any way you can. That's called resources. Then I got another one. It's all about our pilgrimages. And you can actually, if you don't have the money, the time, or the health to go, I have made a movie of every pilgrimage we've taken in the last 15 years. So I've got over 100 2-hour movies on my website that you can actually watch. Join us virtually on a pilgrimage to Poland, Guadalupe, Italy, anywhere, all the places we've gone. That's on, and also Footprints of God. You go to the pilgrimage site. All my books, I have a store there with my books, and my movies are for sale. We have a message board where you can get in conversation with a whole bunch of other Catholics. There's a lot of stuff on there. We have a lot of fun, and it's I think it's kind of a very fun and busy website, CatholicConvert.com. And all my books are there. I have 6 books now. One is my conversion story, Crossing the Tiber, commentary on the Gospel of John, 450 pages. It's really an interesting read on the Gospel of John. I got one Upon This Rock, where I defend the papacy from the first 4 centuries, from the Bible in the first 4 centuries. And then I have one called The Papacy, What the Pope Does and Why It Matters. Another one called The Catholic Faith, which is a study of the creeds. And then number 6 is coming out, which is my book on Genesis. I have all those for sale. I've got over 50 talks that I give, defending the Eucharist, defending Mary, all these, they're either MP3 files or, you know, CDs. So those are all up there too. So it's a busy website, CatholicConvert.com. Thanks for letting me mention it.
And mention your son's website one more time.
Inheritance Pilgrimages.
Okay.
Inheritance. Remember, we're going to teach our kids their inheritance of the faith. Inheritance Pilgrimage or Pilgrimages.com.
We're going to put that in the show notes, make sure that people can find it. Steve Ray, you're an absolute joy to have spent this time with. I appreciate it so very much.
Well, congratulations on your 7th year too. That's not a small feat.
Well, Dave and I, we've been doing this all ourselves, but we've had great guests. You're one of them. Thank you again for coming and joining me along the way. I hope someday to be able to, you know, join you on a pilgrimage. I can't think of a better way to close season 7 with with somebody who knows so much about pilgrimages. If there's anything we can ever do for you, please let us know.
Well, thank you very much. God bless you. I'm happy to join you if you want to do it again sometime on a topic like Mary or the Eucharist or something. We could do that too.
Don't threaten me with a good time, Steve Ray. So for my guest, Steve Ray, my producer, David Imhoff, I'm down the hall, Dave, always praying that your troubles be less, your blessings be more, and nothing but happiness come through your door. We'll see you next time.